In these last few weeks, we've been learning about Avram's life, his two marriages to Sarah, to Hagar, and the children that these two marriages produced, Yishmael and Yitzchak. We'll learn an important halacha from this story. The Torah tells us that after 10 years, Miketz Eser Shanim, Leshev Avram Be'eretz Kanaan, that after 10 years of living in Eretz Canaan with Sarah, that's when Sarah and Avram decided that it's time for Avram to marry Hagar. In other words, after 10 years of living together in Eretz Yisrael, Avram and Sarah, and not being blessed with any children, it was time for Avram to seek other alternative ways to have children. From here we learn in Halacha that if any couple, husband and wife, have been married for 10 years and the marriage did not yield any children, it is a mitzvah for the husband to seek alternative ways of having children, and which means today, basically, to get divorced and marry someone else. But the halacha is that this marker of 10 years only applies if the couple lived in Eretz Yisrael. If the couple did not live in Eretz Yisrael, then there is no obligation to get divorced and find another wife. We learn it from Avram because it says, "Miketz Eser Shanim Leshevas Avram be'Eretz Kanaan." Only after the 10 years that Avram spent with Sarah in Eretz Kanaan, in Eretz Yisrael, that's when they decided that he should marry Hagar. Now Avram was married to Sarah for many years before, decades, but that didn't count. They only counted the 10 years inside Eretz Yisrael. And the same is true for every couple, that if a couple lives in Eretz Yisrael for 10 years and there's no children, that's when halacha encourages the husband to seek an alternative way of having children. Basically get divorced and marry another woman. Now what's the reason for this? Says the Gemara, because if the husband and wife are not living in Eretz Yisrael, then we suspect that the reason why they're not having any children is because they're not living in Eretz Yisrael. In other words, the mitzvah to get divorced and to find another way of having children is only if we suspect that the reason for the lack of having children has to do something with the woman's natural biological makeup. She's an akara, she's a barren woman, and therefore we say, listen, you have to find another way of fulfilling the mitzvah of Purvu, first mitzvah in the Torah. But if you can attribute the reason for the lack of children to anything else, then the halacha is, you don't have to get divorced. Maybe the conditions that prevent having children might go away. It's not a natural thing. Now, here we have a case where the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael has bearing on a marriage. So that if they don't live in Eretz Yisrael because they're not fulfilling that mitzvah, they in a way benefit. They don't have to get divorced because you can attribute the lack of having children to the fact that they're not fulfilling the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. Now we have another case in the Gemara in Ksuvos where the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael affects the halachic status of a marriage. If a couple is married and one of them decides to move to Eretz Yisrael, the halacha is the spouse that wants to go to Eretz Yisrael, while the other one refuses, the one who wants to go to Eretz Yisrael has the upper hand in the marriage. Meaning, normally when there's a divorce, there's grounds for divorce, the husband has a requirement to pay a certain fee that's outlined in the ksuba. That's a condition under the chuppah, that in the ksuba it's outlined that if the husband dies or gets divorced, he has an obligation to give her a certain amount of money so that she can set herself up for life. But what if the woman is the cause of the divorce? Let's say the woman, you know, betrayed the marriage. She was unfaithful. The halacha is, then you don't have to pay a ksuba. The husband can divorce her without paying her because she caused the breakup of the marriage. or for whatever other reason, if she decides one day she doesn't like him, she wants to get divorced, and he wants to stay married, the halacha is that he can say, okay, you want to get divorced, but I don't have to pay you anything. So the halacha here is that if she is the one who's initiating a desire to go to Eretz Yisrael and he refuses, in other words, she's the one who's changing the status quo. They're living outside Eretz Yisrael and she wants to change that. So although she's the cause of the disruption of the marriage, she can still demand a get and get the ketubah paid, because the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael aids her to establish her right to the ketubah. What if it's the other way around? He wants to go to Eretz Yisrael and she refuses. The halacha is that if she refuses, he can give her, they can demand a get, they can decide to give a get, but he doesn't have to pay anything because she is the one who doesn't want to go to Eretz Yisrael. She's the recalcitrant party in this situation, and therefore she's the cause of it, because the mitzvah to go to Eretz Yisrael overrides all other considerations. Now, Tosfos says a remarkable thing, a big chiddush. Nowadays, the mitzvah of going to Eretz Yisrael is somewhat mitigated. In other words, today we cannot fault people for not living in Eretz Yisrael, because Tosfos is talking about, of course, in the Middle Ages, when these conditions were true, namely that it was dangerous to travel from Europe to Eretz Yisrael, a lot of wars and it was a very risky journey to undertake, to go from Europe to Eretz Yisrael. So because it's a sakana, the journey can be very dangerous, you have no obligation to go to Eretz Yisrael. It's what can we do? So therefore, says Tosfos, there's no obligation. If a marriage, since there's no obligation to go to Eretz Yisrael, then therefore in a marriage, if one spouse wants to go to Eretz Yisrael and the other one refuses, we give the upper hand to the one who refuses, because the one who refuses is not changing the status quo, he's not initiating any conditions of disruption in the marriage. It's the one who wants to go to Eretz Yisrael that is initiating this disruption, and therefore they lose. If it's the wife, she doesn't get the ketubah, and if it's the husband, he has to pay the ketubah. Because nowadays, going to Eretz Yisrael cannot be an obligation. So it says the Haflaw, the great Haflaw, Rabbi Pinchas Horowitz, the chief rabbi of Frankfurt, wrote a Sefer on Ksubas. He says, if we accept Tosfos' position, that nowadays there is an overriding factor that suspends the obligation to go to Eretz Yisrael, the mitzvah to go to Eretz Yisrael, because it's too dangerous. Or Tosfos Reb Chaim HaKohen gives another reason why today that mitzvah is being mitigated, is because there's so many halachas while living in Eretz Yisrael, and they're so complicated, and most of us living outside Eretz Yisrael are not so familiar with those halachas. Sometimes it's better not to go to Eretz Yisrael, to forgo the mitzvah in order not to be subject to many more violations, because living in Eretz Yisrael and not fulfilling the mitzvahs associated with the land can accrue to a person a lot of averus. So maybe it's better to not go to Eretz Yisrael and neglect this mitzvah, this one mitzvah, in order not to subject yourself to many averus, which comes as a result of living in the Holy Land. At any rate, given whichever reason we accept, today there's no mitzvah to go. The Chazals tell us, Balatosfos tell us, there's no incumbent mitzvah to move to Eretz Yisrael. So what would be the situation according to that, with regard to a couple that's married for 10 years outside Eretz Yisrael? Now, we said before that if a couple lives for 10 years outside Eretz Yisrael, there's no mitzvah to get divorced, because we attribute the reason for them not having children to the fact that they're not living in Eretz Yisrael. But today, there's no mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, should they get divorced? A couple lives in New York City, 10 years, they're trying to have children, they don't have any children. Should we say that they should get divorced? And the fact they're not living in Eretz Yisrael can no longer be the reason for why they don't have any children, because there's no mitzvah today, according to Reb Chaim HaKohen, according to Tosfos. Says that flow, no, they're not necessarily connected. even according to Tosfos, that there's no mitzvah, because you're an einus. It's not that there's no mitzvah. What they're saying is, it's an einus. It's a life-threatening situation, right? Or it's an einus, and therefore, the rabbis tell us that there's no mitzvah to go to Eretz Yisrael because it's too dangerous. Says the Aflom that it has no bearing on the halacha that living for 10 years without children outside Eretz Yisrael, they don't have to get divorced because it's the lack of going to Eretz Yisrael that we attribute the lack of children. Why? If there's no mitzvah, then why should we attribute it to their not going to Eretz Yisrael? And that's why they're punished not to have children. He says, because even if we exempt people for going to Eretz Yisrael because it's dangerous, it's pikuach nefesh, but that as long as the reason they don't go to Eretz Yisrael is because it's pikuach nefesh, that's when we can say that they're not violating anything, they're not transgressing anything. But what if somebody doesn't like to go to Eretz Yisrael? People like to live in their native countries. People live in Venezuela where it's dangerous today. But they're not moving because cheina mokem al yeshveh, you know, moving to a new place is not easy, especially to Eretz Yisrael. So if the reason they're not going is not because of the treacherous conditions, they're not going because they bechlal don't want to go. He says, then we treat that act of not going, or that lack of action, of not going to Eretz Yisrael, as an avera. And he says, there's a yesod here, there's a fundamental concept. If a Jew is forced to do an avera, but the reason he does the avera is not because he's forced. He anyways doesn't care about it. He does it anyways. For example, a Jew lives in communist Russia, and he's required to show up to work every day, including Shabbos. And he's required to be Mechal Shabbos. And if he doesn't, he gets sent to Siberia and gets killed. It's Pikuach Nefesh. Now, a Jew who shows up to work and he's forced to cook a meal on Shabbos, it's an einus. We can't call it a Chilul Shabbos. So there's a room to debate that maybe after Shabbos, the Jews allowed to eat it, because the halacha is that if you cook on Shabbos, b'shoigig, then after Shabbos you can eat it. If it's b'mezit, the person who cooked can never eat it. What if it's b'oynis? It's even easier than shoigig, it's lighter than shoigig. For sure it should be able to eat. But what if it's a Jew, he's a mechal Shabbos b'chlal, he doesn't care about Shabbos. So when he shows up to work, he's not showing up to work because it's pikuach nefesh. He shows up to work because for him it's a regular day. He's a Mechal Shabbos, even before communism, even before it became an obligation by the law to be Mechal Shabbos, he was Mechal Shabbos Mechlal. He enjoys to work on Shabbos. He's also under duress. But how do we judge his act? Do we define his act as an act done under duress? Or do we define his act as an act done voluntarily? It's an interesting question. Says the Aflom, he has proof from various halachas in Shas that if there are two things simultaneously, there are compelling conditions that the person is under duress where he has to act, he has to commit an avera. But the person happens not to care about the duress, he does it anyways. A good example would be the Nazis. One of the excuses they give today when people judge a former SS officer who was complicit to the Nazi agenda, what choice did we have? If we didn't participate, they would kill us. Yeah, the question is, did you do it because you were afraid to be killed? Or did you do it because you enjoyed being part of this terrible, evil machinery of Nazism? You spoke to someone who... a guy here in the area who revealed to me that his wife's parents were Nazis before the war. They came to America after the war. His mother-in-law was a member of the youth Nazi youth movement, and his father-in-law was a member of the Nazi army. He said that he wasn't participating in the actual persecution of Jews. But he said, you know, you could say they were complicit, but what choice did they have? So we shouldn't judge them. That's interesting. According to that law, if you willingly participated in a crime, even if you also had no choice in the matter, we view your act as if it's done voluntarily. Says the Haflah that this means that if a Jew is married for 10 years and lives outside Eretz Yisrael, he doesn't have to get divorced. Why? The fact that he doesn't go to Eretz Yisrael, if he doesn't go to Eretz Yisrael because he doesn't want to, then we judge this as a Jew not going to Eretz Yisrael voluntarily, not because of the Pikuach Nefesh conditions. And therefore, it could be that he doesn't have children because they don't want to go to Eretz Yisrael. And Avera is still an Avera. I want to just add one more thing. This is a broad topic. And there's many ramifications in Halacha in many areas. But the Rambam in Hilchos Teshuvah talks about free choice. And the Rambam lays down as a foundation that this is something we have to accept. It's a fundamental principle in Jewish faith that we all have a choice. Everybody has a choice. You can do good or you can do bad. It's in your hands. Harishus nesuna l'choladam. Every person has the right, has the privilege, has the choice to take action in accordance with their own conscience. The Rambam challenges this from various places, and then he answers. One of the questions the Rambam asks is from the Mitzrayim. Hashem predicted to Avraham Avinu in the Bris Ben HaBsorim the last few weeks that your children, your descendants will be enslaved to a foreign nation, to Paroi Melech Mitzrayim. If Hashem already predicted it to Avraham in the Bris Ben HaBsorim, then Paroi obviously didn't have any choice. The Mitzrayim didn't have a choice because it was already preordained. So why are they being punished? They don't have free choice. And you're telling me everybody has free choice, and that's why people are punished. But why would the Egyptians be punished? They didn't. God deprived them of their free choice. Says the Rambam that yes, every given Egyptian had the choice not to be the one that Hashem would carry out his preordained plan through him. In other words, Hashem didn't say that every Egyptian will participate. All Hashem said is that the Jews will be enslaved by Egyptians. Every single Egyptian had the choice to say, not me, let it be another Egyptian. And the Ravid argues against this. And he says, well, what do you mean? But ultimately, some Egyptians would have to do it. So ultimately, you can't say that every Egyptian had a choice to say no, because then how would Hashem's decree be fulfilled? If every Egyptian said no, I'm not going to participate with Paroi, then Hashem's plan would not be fulfilled. Anyways, this is a long discussion. But according to the Haflah, let's just look at this situation. If a person's acting voluntarily in a crime, even if there's also a duress hovering over their heads, we ignore the duress and we judge the act as being committed completely voluntarily. If that's true, then the question that the Rambam asks is answered simply. Because basically, every Egyptian, even if there was already a divine decree that they have to enslave the Jews, but they may not have done it because of Hashem. They have done it because they wanted to. Even if it was also preordained that they should enslave the Jews, but the question is, what were they thinking? What motivated them? They weren't motivated being Hashem's agent and fulfilling Hashem's plan. They were motivated by their own viciousness. And the Tosfos Yontov in Pirkei Avos actually mentions that. And the others also say this, and Ravid, I think, mentions it as well. One last thing, which is, I'm surprised that the Haflah doesn't mention this. He brings other interesting halachic evidence to this principle. But there is a simple, for us Lubavitchers, it's very obvious, because the Rebbe mentioned this Rambam thousands of times. The famous Rambam in Hilchos Gerushin. The halach is that a man who gives a divorce under duress, it's not a valid divorce. Nevertheless, we have a halacha that if a husband is abusive or various conditions where Chachamim the Bezdin insist that he must give her a get to free the woman from the shackles of a horrible marriage. The halacha is that if he refuses to give, we make his life difficult. We pressure him and we inflict some painful suffering on him until he relents and says, I'll give, I'm agreeing to give the get. In other words, we want him to say, I agree, because we want it to be voluntary. Ask the Rambam, what is this, lip service? Or what, are we playing games? If he only says, I want to, because we are forcing him, then it's still a get under duress. Why is it a valid get? Yes, you're forcing him to say, I want. But that's just lip service. He doesn't want. If you remove the pressure, he'd say, no, I don't want to. It's only because you're forcing him to do it. So he says, yes, I want. But it doesn't mean anything. But so says the Rambam, the answer is like this. Every Jew, be'etzem, inherently, by nature, wants to do what Hashem wants, which includes also doing what the Rabbanim, the Bezdin, the Chachamim want. And if the Chachamim decree that under certain conditions a husband must give a get to his wife, then be'etzem, deep inside his neshama, he wants to do what Hashem wants. It's just that the Yetzer Hara blurs that inner desire and motivation for the neshama to do the right thing, and he rejects the request of the Chachamim. When the Chachamim make his life difficult, they are basically crushing that obstruction of the Yetzer Hara, and his natural self is able now to emerge freely, and he wants to do what the Chachamim. So when he says, I want to, he's relenting and letting go of that resistance, then inevitably, the fact that he says, I want, must be an expression of his natural desire to do what Hashem wants. Now here's the question. Okay, so we'll accept the Rambam's premise here, that every Jew wants to do what Hashem wants, and therefore when they force him, he agrees to do it by his own consent. His natural desire to do what Hashem wants is coming out and shining in these words, being expressed in the words of Reitz Ani, I want. But still, he's also having a duress. If he doesn't say it, they will keep forcing him until he'll say, I want. So here we have an act of a get, of giving a get, that is done by his own consent, but he's also forced. That means if he doesn't consent, they'll keep forcing him until he gives. So what do we gain? What did the Rambam gain from telling us that the forcing, the duress we impose on the husband is not a problem for the validity of the get, because we don't consider it a get under duress, because we see him giving the get because he wants. But yeah, okay. Okay, we accept that. He wants it. But he's also forced, because if he didn't want, we would force him. So why do we consider the delivery of the get as an act of a voluntary act rather than an act under duress? Doesn't that prove the vote of the haflah, that if an act is done voluntarily, even if there is also in the background a condition of duress that forces, that doesn't give the person the choice to act otherwise, we still judge the act as an act that's done freely by free choice? Just an interesting discussion. There are other things that we can add to this, because this has to do with a lot of other issues in halacha. One of them, Matan Torah, says that Hashem forced the Jewish people to accept the Torah. Kafalem Harki Gigis, Hashem put the mountain over our heads and says, accept the Torah. Now, the Gemara says that this was a good excuse. It's a good excuse that every Jew can use in the afterlife, when after you finish your life here on earth, and if they judge you in the heavens and say, why didn't you keep this mitzvah, that mitzvah? You say, well, we accepted it under duress. We weren't willing to accept it. We were forced into it. Hashem held the mountain over our heads. So Tosfos says there, but the Jews said Nasa v'Nishma before Matan Torah already. So why did Hashem hold the mountain over their heads? The Jews agreed to it. Says Taisus, yeah, it's true that the Jews already consented to it before Hashem held the mountain over their heads. So in other words, they got into this commitment of Torah by their own volition. But why did Hashem hold the mountain over their head? Just in case they renege on that consent, because they see the fire and they get very scared and they decide, oh no, we change our minds. Just to be sure that Jews don't change their minds, Hashem forced them also. Now here's the question. If Jews really wanted to accept the Torah, but Hashem held the mountain over our heads just as an extra precaution, why is this a good... Why does the Gemara say, Mikan Madoy Rabo Lo Raisa? Here is a great excuse that every Jew has if he neglects to do a mitzvah, saying, hey, we were forced into it. Yeah, but we also wanted it. According to the Haflah, the fact that you wanted it makes the act a voluntary act, not an act under duress. So where's the excuse? Tell the Chacham v'yach kamayit.